This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, Now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. For his perspective on this and so much more going on in the world of politics, we're joined by veteran political correspondent Craig Oliver. Hey, good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Dave. So we're finally back to normal, Dave, or anything as normal as can ever get around here when it comes to our two borders.
Yeah, let's call it normal.
Yeah, that's nice.
Normal with some quotation marks around it. And Craig, I don't really have an elaborate or insightful question in regard to the border other than to ask you, what's your reaction to the news?
Well, it's about time. As your listener was saying in the last segment, it's been since the pandemic first hit that the land border has been closed to all but essential travel. And that has been very difficult. And all of this time, you can hear the moaning and crying and complaints from people who have places where they could go in Florida in the winter, unlike me and you, complaining bitterly about the inconsistencies. Why is the air border open to essential travel and some non-essential travel? And why isn't the land border? Well, it will be now in about in a couple of weeks, maybe sooner. But there's still some questions here. Are they going to allow mixed bag people who basically have had both inoculations, both shots, from two different companies? Are they going to permit that? At the moment, they don't like that idea and wouldn't accept it. And particularly, there are questions about AstraZeneca, which the Americans don't really approve of. So there are a couple of questions here that are going to be very important to Canadians. What are the credentials you require when you get to the border in order to make it a smooth transition?
Well, Craig, you mentioned the vaccine side of this conversation, which then leads us into the vaccine mandate conversation, which is really coming to a head on this side of the border. The province of Quebec is standing firm on its mask mandate, vaccine mandate for frontline healthcare workers. Around 3,000 nurses and 25 patient attendants remain unvaccinated against COVID-19, according to Health Minister Christian Dubé. Any worker not fully vaccinated by Friday will be suspended without pay. This is the first time we've really seen the rubber hit the road.
Dave, look, I think what we're seeing is the same mentality, the same emotional reaction almost on the part of governments as we're seeing in Quebec. And just to finish with Quebec for a second, they are really being brutal. But necessity brutal. They're saying nurses and other healthcare workers will be deprived of their credentials if they will not accept a vaccine mandate. Now, that is really bringing down the hammer on them. But I think what's happened here is governments all tried to be nicey-nicey. I think the title of this segment could be No More Mr. Nice Guy. The provincial governments have all decided on their own, pretty much, that this can't be fooled around with. This is about life and death, and no more fooling around. You either agree to be vaccinated with all of the necessary vaccinations, or you lose your job. No question. We're not going to accept phony letters from people who aren't really doctors. They're going to be looking closely at that. And so this is a very tough reaction, but I think the governments have all agreed that they just can't fool with this, and now it's time to get tough.
Craig, we know the rubber's hitting the road in Quebec on this front. It's also coming to a head in Ontario this week. Yeah. Although the governments are certainly in the right position here in regards to people who are serving on the front lines, oftentimes dealing with vulnerable individuals, is there a risk here? Is this politically risky if it impacts the delivery of healthcare?
Well, I don't think it does impact the delivery of healthcare. If you mean that there may be some big holes in the man and woman power, there may be some holes there. Yeah, Ontario's hiring 4,000 new healthcare workers and boosting up their financial situation because they believe there will be quite a few people who won't come back. Some are still refusing, even if they, I know someone who's leaving the country to go somewhere else to get work.
And so this is
applying right across the country. But overall, the word is success. In some cases where they've gone from 81, 82% of people vaccinated, they're now up to 95%. So, I mean, this has this sort of no more fooling around rule by the provinces has led, I think, to a lot of people who said they would never do it, getting themselves vaccinated, especially healthcare workers. And you got to wonder, I mean, what kind of responsibilities, ethical responsibilities, did they take on when they went for these jobs? Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be making science, their decisions backed by science. Instead, they've been saying, we won't take it, and we'll go back to work and possibly infect people. Mm-hmm. This is what has become so impossible for most Canadians to understand. And that's why politically, I think all of these governments are safe.
So let's talk about the politics here. We did mention this briefly last week, but we know federal vaccination mandates are coming down the pipeline as well. And what is going to happen with members of parliament who refuse to get the jab? If public servants and folks who work at airports mm-hmm. have to get shots or be suspended without pay, shouldn't that standard apply to politicians?
Yeah, I mean, I think the House of Commons is there to represent the best of Canada. And the best of Canada is that people get themselves vaccinated in their own interests, but also in the interests of people who they are spending time with. It's hard for me to imagine why the House of Commons should get an exception. And I think this is going to be a real struggle. And it gives obviously, everything's politics when you talk about the House of Commons. It gives a real edge to the Prime Minister over the Conservative leader, because he's going to have to do something about his MPs who will not accept vaccination. We don't know how many of them there are, but we do know there are some. And should we set up special deals for them that will allow them to work virtually? I don't see why we should have to do that. And I think a lot of people will say exactly that. Why make it easy for them when we're not making it easy for a nurse in Quebec or a nurse in Vancouver?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Craig, let's turn our attention back internationally. Canada has joined G20 allies in pushing Afghanistan's new Taliban rulers to make it easier for humanitarian aid to reach the country's people. During a virtual summit, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his fellow G20 leaders discussed the crisis in Afghanistan. And the European Union emerged from that summit announcing a package of $1.4 billion, about two-thirds of which was new money. Canada was not part of that financial agreement. Craig, as the crisis unfolded in Canada in August, Canada did offer up to $50 million through the World Bank and the United Nations. But why do you think Canada excluded themselves from this time's financial support?
I think there was a mistake made, or perhaps a little absent-mindedness, because we're told by government officials that we didn't know this was going to be one of those conferences in which we had to pony up money. It wasn't supposed to be. And so lo and behold, we got there. And 27 European countries, the EU, put $1.4 billion on the line for Afghanistan. And they said, we're not ignoring Afghanistan. Nobody told us. It's hard to believe that nobody told them that they might be expected to pony up a few bucks. And as you say, they do point out that they have given in the millions, but nothing near what Europeans are offering to the UN and to other organizations to help with the suffering that's now taking place and the starvation, perhaps of many children, according to the people who are there in Afghanistan. Mm. And of all places, we should be helping. And we are, but not to the degree that people expected us to.
Craig, this question might be getting a little bit too deep into the weeds, but what's the tightrope balancing act that Canada, its international partners, and so many organizations have to do in this situation where there is a humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, but maybe they're not able to ensure that money they're giving is going to get directly to people?
Yeah, corruption in these countries is a huge issue in many of them, not just in Afghanistan, of course. And the money just slips through fingers. And the president one day leaves and takes $1 billion with him. This happens too much. All they can say, governments everywhere, is, look, we're dealing through trusted partners. We're dealing through the United Nations. We're dealing through other NGOs, non-government organizations that we trust and we know, and we have to depend on them. They're there to see that what they're seeing on the ground is the money that's being spent. Mm. And the governments say they can't do much more than that. They do send officials over to check on how things are looking, but that's not easy in Afghanistan right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Craig, let's come back to Canada. The Department of National Defense, a federal court justice, has ruled the Liberal government does not have to reinstate Major General Danny Fortin as head of Canada's vaccine distribution campaign. Justice Anne-Marie McDonald decided if Fortin was not happy with being removed after allegations of sexual misconduct, he should file a formal complaint with mm-hmm. the military and not the courts. Craig, once again, we find ourselves circling back to accusations of military misconduct. I know we've talked about it extensively, but as Prime Minister Justin Trudeau lays out his new cabinet, what do you imagine he'll do with the defense portfolio, especially when there is a reckoning brewing inside the Department of National Defense?
Well, first, I don't know why Danny Fortin would want to be the chief of defense staff these days. It is an organization which has really been badly hit in terms of morale and stature in the eyes of Canadians. It's very damaged. And it's going to be very difficult in the coming months to be one of the leaders of that organization. But I think the bottom line here is that the Prime Minister cannot bring back the defense minister he had before, who didn't feel it was his job to run the place. I don't know what he thought his job was, and he clearly knew nothing of what was going on. And he was the longest-running defense minister in Canada in years. And he was totally, completely inept. Mm-hmm. So the Prime Minister has got to find himself a very strong defense minister. I will be stunned if he comes back with the defense minister he had before.
Yeah, I'm even wondering if they might try and split the portfolio up, one to kind of deal with the Department of National Defense and one specifically tasked with dealing with sexual misconduct in the military. But we'll see what they want to do in terms of creativity down the line there. Craig, we've only got a couple minutes left here, but you wanted to make mention of something going on in regards to equalization, which is going to be taking place next Monday. We know how oftentimes many provinces gripe about equalization payments, and you've got a bit of insight on a vote coming down the pipeline next Monday.
Well, not just me, other reporters also. I don't want to pretend that this is any big scoop. Monday is municipal elections in Alberta, and the premier will do anything he can to try to take the heat off his really mediocre management of the pandemic in that province, which has been a Canadian leader in just about all of the bad numbers that one can get. So Monday, when you sit down to vote for a reeve and a counselor and a school board member and maybe a lot of other senior officials, municipally, mayors, you'll find there hidden away a question about should Alberta get rid of equalization. So that is the referendum on equalization that the premier promised eventually. And there it is. Of course, he can't do it, but he can't go to the trouble of telling people that's impossible. That is written into the Constitution. No province, and especially Alberta, can get rid of equalization. And how can I forget that when Alberta was in trouble in 21, when things were getting very, very difficult for them, the federal government took up their revenue loss and gave them $10 billion. Furthermore, equalization is not a provincial program. It's a federal program. Mm-hmm. The money from it is distributed by the federal government, not by the provinces. And finally, if Alberta did have a bit of an edge over some other countries in terms of how much it gave in equalization, please note that for many years, Alberta has been the highest per capita salary province in the country. So that's why they may appear to have been giving more than others. The provinces that receive the most are Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick. Is the premier saying they don't deserve it? He's going nowhere with that argument, I think, but it'll be intriguing to see what people think when they see that on their vote on Monday.
Nothing stokes political flames in Alberta like talk of equalization. Nothing stokes our flames like your insight, Craig. Thank you for making time for us this morning.
You're welcome, Dave. As always, it's fun.
You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.